You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in rainy Bogota, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. But it doesn't feel like we can see any stars. We certainly can't see any stars, and we can't see any sky at the moment. It's permanently overcast. The winter is truly upon us. The city floods every afternoon when we have a rainfall. It doesn't paint a very pretty picture, but maybe we have similar weather to our very special guest on this episode 226, who's down in Exeter. Well, to be precise, she's in Exwick in the UK. So she's a PhD, well, MPhil PhD candidate at the University of Exeter. And some of those of you who are listening out there will know that that's where I did my undergrad. So in fact, Diana Maria Valencia and I met at an Exeter alumni reunion in Bogota. I think it was last year indeed, in fact. And yeah, we got to talking about her studies and what was going on in Columbia. And you know, we've kept in contact, and I'm happy to say she's an avid listener of the Columbia Calling podcast. But, you know, it's good to have someone on the show, you know, from an academic perspective to talk. And we're going to talk today about the upcoming elections in Colombia, May 27th, the first round. And then, of course, a month later, there'll be the second round if it comes to that. But I think that probably will. And, we're going to talk to someone who's got a very academic background, who knows Colombia very well. And she's doing her studies in food insecurity. So it's, you know, all about the agrarian counter reforms in Colombia and things that, well, if you boil the conflict down to its most base elements, one of the great problems here in Colombia is, of course, the agrarian policy and the lack of agrarian reform they've taken place, let's say, but they've not been put into effect. So let's just, before I stick my foot in my mouth and get things wrong talking to an expert on this, let me introduce Diana Maria Valencia over the line from there down in the southwest of England. Diana, welcome to Columbia Calling.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Richard. Hello, everybody, wherever you are.
All over the world, I hope to say. Diana, you are a Bogotana, but your parents are from various parts of Colombia. So like most people who've come to Bogota, but you feel like someone from Bogota. You've got you have the Bogota feeling in your blood?
I have the Bogota feeling in my blood, I guess. Yeah, I grew up loving those mountains and Montserrat and Guadalupe and the buildings and everything, Candelaria, the chaos.
It's true, isn't it?
You
learn to embrace the chaos, and then you'll survive and enjoy yourself in Bogota. And now you did your undergraduate at the Universidad Distrital, so opposite the Javeriana, right down there in like 42, 43. You won the scholarship that I know that this wealthy family from England award to exceptional Colombian students to come over to study. I guess it's a One Planet MBA and other things, and you came over and you did, if I'm not mistaken, sort of social politics and biosciences, and then you did a specialization at the Universidad Militar, and now you're doing the MPhil PhD in history. I mean, you've jumped around a bit when it comes to academia.
Yeah, but it's the other way around. I did my specialization before.
Yeah.
I started with an engineer in Universidad Distrital, and then I started to work as everybody. Did my specialization in Universidad Militar in project management and worked a lot in logistics at national level. I work with rural development and food security projects in Colombia for a while, and then I decided to keep on studying because I kind of love the academia and the classrooms and the homeworks and tests and essays. I'm a bit of a weirdo in that way. And so I was awarded an Ayudar Scholarship for Colombians here in Exeter. I studied an MSc in Food Security and Sustainable Agriculture, which is, in fact, as you said, a combination of many points of view, social, political, and, of course, bioscience. Actually, the MSc belongs to the bioscience department at the University of Exeter. You can say belong, like we biosciences. And then I decided to keep walking that academic path. I liked research a lot. So I decided for a PhD. I kind of sold my own project to the University of Exeter and was awarded again with an international scholarship. Mm-hmm. Now I'm with the Department of History and I'm researching around the relation in between the agrarian counter reforms in Colombia from 1961 till 2011 and how they are linked with food insecurity, with hunger and displacement and violation of peasants' rights and lack of food sovereignty in peasant communities in Colombia. I'm right now in my first year, so doing a lot of reading and dealing with a lot of secondary researchers so far. And, probably going to Colombia during my second year to do my fieldwork.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's a 50-year period and also quite a fractured 50-year period, 61-2011. I mean, that's more or less when the contemporary conflict is believed to have started, although they put the date of the 64, but 61, it was still a very violent place. And I mean, 50 years to cover. First of all, you're not a weirdo in liking the homework and the investigations and studying, as it's you and me both in this situation. But 50 years is a long period of time to be delving into such depth. Give us a little bit of a background into this, into food insecurity or food security and agrarian counter reforms in Colombia. If you can just explain to my listeners in the most, my listeners are a very intelligent bunch, but perhaps we're not familiar with the themes, the topics of food security and agrarian reforms in Colombia.
Okay, first of all, why 1961 and 2011? Because I'm investigating the period in between two very important laws. The first one is the agrarian reform, JEDAS in 1961, which is the 135 law, if I'm not mistaken. And in 2011, we have the victims law, the 1448 law. So land restitutions is linked with this, in between this law and the agrarian reform. So both laws were aiming to return the land to peasants, to give back land in a sort of way, particularly the victims law to the ones that claimed to be finally displaced from their own lands. So that's why I picked that period of time. And yes, it's a bit of modern history, but I think it's a key period of time to do the analysis in case of agrarian reform, or what I call agrarian counter-reform, because I'm more interested in counter-reforms, not how land has been distributed, because it hasn't been, actually, but how there has been reversely distributed, taken away from peasants, not only by law, like through the Pacto de Chicoral after the law in 1961, but also in a bad way, like by land grabbing. And how, of course, when that metabolism that exists in between peasants and land is broken, then you can have periods of hunger, or you don't have the same access to natural resources, human rights violation, undernourishment, food instability. So all of those are indicators of food insecurity. Food security is to have access to nutritious and healthy food with stability within a period of time. If you lose that stability, you suffer periods of hunger, undernourishment, not enough access to healthy, nutritious food, then you're in a state of food insecurity. Of course, in the case of peasants, it links with another important concept, that is food sovereignty, like to be able to have self-sufficiency in terms of getting food for yourself and your family.
Which, of course, is a huge issue. I mean, when you go down into rural Colombia, what do the people want? They just want to be able to provide for their family. I mean, we're talking about the most basic desire that people have. And when you get out into the wilds of Antioquia, further adrift into places like Guaviare or Arauca, people want the basic needs covered, especially in the coast as well. So you're studying all of this. Are there any particular areas of Colombia that you are studying in greater depth?
I'm interested right now in Cauca, Antioquia, and Cordoba. So, but I'm still trying to figure out which could be the best place to carry the research, because I need to make sure to have enough farm resources, good archival management, which is something really, really difficult at regional level in Colombia to find. So, but yeah, my interest is in the north part of Antioquia, probably Montes de Maria, which is probably Cordoba, Sucre, some places like that. But definitely the combination of different factors that cause food insecurity and agrarian counter reforms, not only the contradictory policies and laws, but also the land grabbing, the land displacement, have taken place.
I mean, those three, I mean, I can think of other departments, but Cordoba, Antioquia, and Cauca are incredibly fraught departments. Cauca, to this day, remains a real issue, and I think you'll end up investigating lots of, you'll have to get in touch with all of the different indigenous caciques and so on. It'll be interesting, that one. And then Antioquia, of course, because of its background and the violence that has taken place in Antioquia. If you do Montes de Maria, which I know reasonably well, in Cordoba, well, I have an anecdote about Cordoba, which I learned in doing my studies for my PhD about a year ago. It's in Peru when they did the agrarian reform, the agricultural reform in the, I guess it was the 1960s, and they're seizing the land from massive landowners. There was the biggest hacienda, or the biggest finca in Peru, was only 30,000 hectares large. Now in Cordoba, I think there are fincas and haciendas of more than 500,000 hectares, something like that. I don't know the full. There are fincas that are so big that one person can't possibly own them. And that's not me being some pinko liberal. It's just ridiculous. And how they dealt with it in Peru is that when they started the reform, the military moved in, and each soldier, who, of course, coming from the working class, these conscripts, got a portion of land themselves. They received. And therefore, you got this appropriation of what they were doing amongst the citizens and amongst the soldiers, amongst the class. And so it actually, I mean, I don't know if it worked perfectly, but it seemed to work. I don't know how Colombia is going to deal with this, because as if things become more transparent, surely there should be more reforms, but I don't know. I mean, we'll leave that to you. You're the expert investigator to try and bring a, you know, you need to call on history and thinking ahead. How do we move forward as a country into this sort of more equal, let's say, situation?
Yeah, the idea of analyze the history of the agrarian reform and counter-reforms in Colombia is to take a look at those learned lessons from the past, why agrarian reforms in the past didn't work. And it's not only the good violence we have, as you said, the huge latifundios working on Colombia. And also, it's not only about distributing the land, I guess. It's also give them the opportunity to have productive projects, subsidize it or help people to actually do something with the land, because just the ownership of the land is not enough. And that probably has been the problem since the independence. During the independence, many of the squatters was broken and the land was given to the indigenous people. Because, the private property was blooming at the time.
Yeah.
And then when they couldn't actually make them productive, they ended up selling those lands. And it has happened with many other reforms in Colombia. The people in the end leave their lands or sell them for, not really fair price. Because we also have a lot of land price speculation when you're in a conflict atmosphere like you have in Colombia. So, we need to deal with that, not only giving the land, but also giving the meanings of production, building the infrastructure, because right now Colombia also doesn't have the proper roads, highways, warehouses, the stock capacity built to provide the commercialization for all those agrarian products.
It's true, absolutely true, completely, completely on point in that one. So just one of the myriad of issues under one umbrella, let's say, that affect Colombia for this next period, next foreseeable period in Colombia's future. Very interesting to talk about this. We've never had someone of your knowledge talking about this sort of thing on Colombia Calling. So we're quite flattered to have you on the line from Exeter. But let me remind people as we wind down this first segment of the show, we're talking to Diana Maria Valencia, who's a MPhil PhD candidate in history down there in Exeter, so where I did my undergraduate and misspent youth in England's southwest. Why did I choose Exeter? That's another story. But I won't get into that now. But anyway, she's down there enjoying herself, doing her studies and talking to us on the line about, let's say, agrarian counter-reforms, reforms, food security or food insecurity in Colombia. And of course, this really does dovetail into lots of the issues that are being discussed or were discussed at very least between 2012 and 2016 in the dialogues between the FARC and the Colombian government, which were signed off on in 2016 in November, but still need to be signed into law, many of the issues, and indeed are up for debate at the moment, as we are in the, let's say, leading up to May 27th and the presidential elections here in this country. It's a very interesting time. So we're going to take a short break and come back with Diana Maria and talk further about the elections, and especially from her perspective as an academic with, you know, very profound knowledge in agricultural agrarian issues in Colombia, one of the base issues in the country for behind the conflict, in my personal opinion. I'd love to hear from you guys out there what you think. Of course, you can get in touch with us, ColombiaCalling@gmail.com, on Twitter, Colombia Calling, and indeed on Facebook, Colombia Calling as well. We're on all the social media ills, especially in this age, in this period that's let's say, the discord around social media. But without further ado, we're going to take a short break and come back with Diana Maria and talk further about Colombian politics. Thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're on the line to Diana Maria Valencia, who's in Exeter, or Ex-Wick, just beside Exeter. She's doing her PhD, MPhil PhD, down there in history. And we've been talking about food security, food insecurity, agrarian counter-reforms, agrarian reforms in Colombia. So fascinating stuff. I mean, I really do find, I think we could talk for hours about issues in Colombia surrounding the agrarian situation. But we are talking on this episode 226 about the elections, May 27th. Now, let me give you a brief background. And so we've got essentially, well, five candidates at the moment, although, you know, three are sort of dipping away, but well, everything can change. But we've got leading the pack, we've got Iván Duque, who's in first place at the moment for the main elections on May 27th. Iván Duque is the chosen one for Álvaro Uribe. As most of you out there will know, what Uribe says flies in a lot of the country. And so Iván Duque is the chosen person to lead the Centro Democrático, the Democratic Center Party. Neither center, not a central party, so it's a right-wing party. Then in second place, we've got Gustavo Petro, who's the former mayor of Bogotá. And prior to that, he was an M19 guerrilla. Well, a long way prior to that, because he was a senator as well. Very good opposition politician, and he's on the left of the spectrum. So what can you tell from this? We're already polarized. The two front runners are left and right. So we've got a nice polarized situation. This is Colombia. And then we've got the sort of people behind there. We've got Sergio Fajardo, former mayor of Medellin, former governor of Antioquia, very successful businessman when it came to Antioquia. He pitches himself as the outsider. He's for the Green Party. This is not an environmental party. It's a nicely named Green Party. He pitches himself as a political outsider, but he has been in politics for the last 16 years. Beyond that, you have Humberto de la Calle, who was their chief negotiator in the peace talks between the FARC and the government between 2012 and 2016. Humberto Lacalle was a former vice president to Ernesto Samper. He was actually running against Ernesto Samper in those elections, and for the Liberal Party came in second, but second with a sizable amount of votes, so therefore was given the position of vice president, and the only person to leave that administration unscathed by scandal. We can talk about that further. And then in sort of a has also ran is Vivian Morales in fifth place. And I'm embarrassed to say I'm not even entirely sure who she's running for. Is it the Mira party? Diana, you can tell me. Who is Vivian Morales leading?
I think she's going independent.
Independent, okay.
Her background is the Liberal Party, actually, but he wasn't included in the Liberal consultation. So, yeah, I don't know which movement she's representing. But,
Not sure at all. So, I mean, you know, you're a Colombian, you're overseas, so you're maybe viewing this through a different filter. This election, you're reading, obviously you'll be reading the national newspapers, the Colombian newspapers, but also the international press, I think. How do you feel as we are just over a month, let's say, from the presidential election's first round?
I'm trying to see things positively. like at least we're in a better situation than 4 years or 8 years ago, I guess. Like we have a very nice pool of candidates, and we're no longer talking just about terrorism and war and fag. No, the debates are more about education, climate change, health service. So I think it's been an improvement. And but things, as you said, you can feel the polarization. Polarization is a word I'm not really comfortable with because very recently it's like a common accusation these days, or almost a bad joke in between Colombians, because everybody talks about polarization. And if you talk about polarization, then you're accused to be polarizing as well. So it's a bit confusing. I wouldn't say that there's a polarization between Petro Luque or yes, no, because probably it comes from the last peace referendum. But yeah, at least the same polarization is like a valid strategy, I don't know, within the discourse. And it's good that, that right now the debate has changed, and I think in a good way.
I think you're right, and I like being corrected as well. I like you bringing up that the issue that me saying polarization. I like that. It's, you know, we should push back on these terms, and I am a victim of the press. So I think the most positive thing to come out of this presidential, let's say, run-in is that there is debate. And as you say, we don't seem to have the common enemy of always saying, oh, you know, the militarization, we need to militarization, we need to hammer the FARC, we need to do this. They've tried in some circles to paint the second guerrilla group or the remaining guerrilla group, the ELN, as that new common enemy. But I don't think the tactic has overwhelmingly worked. Although, I mean, there's still time for some scandals or some awful issues to have taken place and then, you know, to swing public opinion. But I do like debate, and it's very close at the moment. And, you know, you don't get anyone who's sitting on the fence, let's say, here in Colombia. I talk to everyone, and you know, staff at my little hotel and so on. They've all got an opinion. And this is like for the first time ever, really, since I've been coming to Colombia in 1998. Before, I talked to my staff. They're like, yeah, we're not voting. We're not doing anything, or we'll sell our votes because, you know, nothing will change for us. You know, these are people who live on the minimum wage. This time, they're actually genuinely interested. This has to be a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. I like to see people trying to get more informed and try to take the best decision in terms of their vote. And that's good. It's definitely a good change.
How do you feel in regards to these presidential hopefuls? Have you been watching the debates?
Yes, I have. Most of them, even the vice presidential debates, have been really interesting.
And so, what, I mean, what have you taken from these debates? How do you feel? Has it changed the way you're going to vote if you vote? I'm not going to ask you who you're going to vote for. I mean, we'll keep that confidential. That's beside everyone. But I mean, has it swung your opinion somewhat, having seen these presidential or vice presidential debates?
I think they have been what I expected. Mm-hmm. In terms of the candidates, you could expect that the candidates that have been congressmen, for example, or Claudia that has been also in the Senate, they really could excel in the debate. Mm. Other candidates are less fluid and articulate and don't think as quickly as they do, but they have had a good chance to show their political views and their programs, which is the important thing, actually.
That's interesting.
To know the proposals.
Yeah. Because this is the first time I think, in recent memory, I can remember the candidates talking about proposals. Really, before they didn't.
I'm trying to. I remember that the debates at least have been popular during the second round, like after the second round of elections, like only between the two remaining candidates, the top two, not before. But it's a good exercise, like to have them all there, like in some sort of panel, asking questions in between themselves, arguing and making counter arguments one to each other is a good exercise. It has been really interesting.
You know what? I've overlooked someone important as well. I forgot to mention Vargas Lleras. Could you should have corrected me. I mean, because he's very much in the running as well, because he's promoted himself as the business candidate.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but he's for me. For me, he represents much of the same. I mean, you know, he's relatives who've been president and so on. He represents much of, I mean, I know that Santos backed him the other day, but he represents very much more of the same. And I think people feel they want to break from that. But let me ask you a question about Humberto de la Calle. This is the man who seems like a really decent guy. You know, when he talks well. He seems to have his thoughts in order. Again, historically speaking, the only person to have left the Samper, let's say, government without a scandal attached to him. He's the head negotiator of the peace dialogues. Gave a very poignant speech about, you know, when the peace dialogues were agreed. Well, sort of pre-agreed, let's say, in Cartagena, the first sort of pomp and ceremony there. Why is he so far behind? I mean, you'd think that someone who has who represents a possible peaceful future between two warring factions in Colombia would garner more votes and more. More popularity in the opinion polls, or, I mean, do we think that in this day and age there's a manipulation of these polls, or Colombians just aren't ready for someone like Humberto de la Calle? Well, I mean, you're an academic, you must have thought about this, Diana. Well, how do you feel?
Well, if I look at it objectively, I think that he's the best CV.
Yeah.
In terms of CV, in terms of his political career, is the best one. And of course, he's a gentleman. He's what we call todo un señor. Yeah, everything you've said. But I think that there are two factors I don't like about his being his candidate.
Yeah.
His candidatura, I've heard you say that.
Yeah.
What about, I disagree with some bits of his program that I don't really like. But particularly, I don't like the Liberal Party. And I think that it's the Liberal Party who's pushing him down. Because it's a traditional party that is also a bit like what Vargas Lleras represents. But what you've said before is more of the same.
Yeah.
It's the traditional party that has been there forever, and they also, how can I put this? You remember that we have a Senate election like a month ago.
Yeah.
There have been some candidates for the Senate that represent the same clientelism and corruption that we had before. You know, but there are some previous senators and congressmen that are actually in jail or in the middle of investigations because of corruption. So what they did is to name like an heir. People has inherited those boats paid with corrupted money, what we call the candidates in Cuerpo Ajeno. Liberal Party had like more than 20 of those. Humberto del Calle actually spoke out loud about it, saying he disagreed with that, of course, but the Liberal Party just ignored him. And you know that actually the chief of the Liberal Party, ex-president Gaviria, yeah, is kind of going one way different to De La Calle. He's not actually fully supporting him. So I think that the main factor contributing to that very low representation of De La Calle in polls is the party, certainly the party.
I think the Liberal Party and these traditional old parties need a shake up, don't they? A sort of reform within them, and of course this is seen by the Gaviria rift, let's say, between him and Humberto de la Calle. And I found it very interesting that it was Gaviria supposedly who spoke out against a potential alliance between Fajardo and de la Calle. Isn't that right?
Yeah, well, he blamed Fajardo about the alliance not being possible. Fajardo was always in the position of, yes, I could have this coffee with De La Calle, but I'm not really interested in the Liberal Party for the reasons I just told you. And I think that, of course, Gaviria didn't like that very much. But also, Gaviria has other plans in mind, I guess. And because De La Calle has no real chance to actually win the as president, to be a president, I think that he's more interested in what will happen after elections with the Liberal Party. So probably what I see, what I think, my guess, my feelings, tell me that he's trying to turn the Liberal Party in what the Conservative Party is right now, just trying to be with the winner one and get as much jobs and positions as I could get for my party. Just being there, remain there with no actual leadership within the government. So he right now is thinking beyond the first round of elections. He's thinking about the second round of elections.
Okay.
And try to bet for the winner one.
So he's already forward planning on this one. So let's jump then to Duque, who's leading, Ivan Duque, who's leading the opinion polls, let's say, of voting opinion polls. And he's the chosen figure by Álvaro Uribe, the controversial ex-president between 2002 and 2010, two terms. He's been chosen. He's been depicted by many as a puppet. His CV has been meticulously taken apart in some sections of the press. But what do we feel about him? Do we feel that he is just going to be a spokesperson for Uribe? Is he going to be like what happened in Guatemala between Efraín Ríos Montt and Portillo back in the day when he just put his puppet in power? I'm loath to say that he's a puppet, but I don't know. I'm reading everything I can. I can't vote, so I'm just watching and I'm waiting. And what do you feel about Ivan Duque, Diana?
I completely agree with you. I mean, any Colombian, or most of Colombians I know, if they were here instead of me with you, they would say, yes, he's definitely going to be a puppet. I'm not so sure. Probably he will be, but because he's so young, and he doesn't really have any administrative experience. Like, he, as far as I know, he never been in charge of a work thing, like as a leader. So he's probably going to need that coaching. But also, he by himself has appeared very independent in the debates. I don't know if that's, I don't know, a mask. But I couldn't possibly be 100% sure if he is or is not going to be Uribe's puppet, as was everybody is thinking. Even the Uribistas, I think that they're following him because they truly believe that it's going to be like having Uribe again behind the power. I wouldn't be so sure, really.
It's tough as well, that. Let's finish up then on the most, perhaps the most controversial of them all, Gustavo Petro, for whom I worked for 12 days before quitting. In the Alcaldía de Bogotá, he's pretty controversial, and I've just read something off the website Columbia Reports just now saying one of Latin America's most controversial spin doctors, Venezuelan Juan José Rendón, who of course we know was involved in the last elections, said Wednesday that he is actively trying to influence elections in Colombia to prevent a possible victory of leftist candidate Gustavo Petro. So we're getting all of this news coming out, he's going to turn us into Venezuela, he wants to be like Chavez, he wants this. I mean, this is surely fear-mongering, right? I mean, there are people behind this.
I think it is. Like, all this fear against things like Castrochavismo, which is like a made-up word that we use in Colombia to link Venezuela with the Cold War days. Doesn't really make more sense. But many, many people in Colombia actually believe that this Castro Chavismo threat is for real. I don't think so. Still, you can't deny that Petro is like, he represents some sort of a late pink wave progressism in Colombia. And I think it's very, very difficult for him to win as a president. I mean, Colombia, and I think that many people have said it before in this podcast, is very conservative in terms of elections. So I don't really think that Colombia is ready, or not ready. I don't think that we will vote for a left alternative to get the presidency.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one, because I think Colombia just at its core is conservative. The cities may vote one way, but there's this new student, let's say, student movement coming through, the sort of millennials, different thinking, maybe like the same type of voting public, like which brought Jeremy Corbyn up, that kind of thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, not saying it's a good thing. I just think it's an interesting time. I'm unfortunately, talking of time, we have no more, but it's been fascinating because this election, I mean, I'm sure I'm going to find more people to talk about it as we approach the D-Day, let's say, the 27th, and then a month later, the second round, which looks inevitably between Duque and Petro. I've been wrong before, listeners. I've been wrong many times before about, my, let's say, opinions and predictions, let's say, for politics, and especially here in Colombia. Anything can happen, but really interesting to hear a balanced and very thoughtful set of opinions from Diana Maria over there, as an expat Colombian in England, watching from overseas the elections here in Colombia. So maybe she's got a different filter on on what's going on. She can step back from the noise of the campaigning that we hear here in Colombia. I don't know. Do you feel a little bit separate over there as we wind down this interview, Diana?
Not really. I wish that I've been very involved in the debate in social networks more than what I wanted. And because I'm part of an initiative that we'll probably talk more later, which is Post La Verdad, who have conducting different series of debates around the campaigns and the candidates. So I've been in the middle of a debate, and yeah, it's sometimes it's exhausting. Sometimes you need to put distance in between your work and yourself and Colombia's election atmosphere, because it's quite heavy.
Yeah.
And people are very passionate about it. But yeah, I wish I could actually take at some point. So I've been sort of involved in the middle of all that noise.
Yeah, well, let me just plug that, because they, you know, Diana has been involved in this podcast called Post La Verdad on Spreaker, and you can hear it in Spanish, and very interesting interviews and obviously political dialogue about Colombia. So for those of you Colombians or any Spanish speakers interested in something a bit different, do check that out. I'll put the link on our Facebook page so people can see it. But let me take this moment to say thank you so much to Diana Maria Valencia, who's student, PhD candidate in history, down there at the University of Exeter. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show, Diana, and I'm sure we'll have you back. Maybe we can have you back after the second round to talk about the subsequent new president.
Yeah, why not? it's been a pleasure, actually. Thank you for having me. And yeah, why not? Anytime.
Yeah, I won't take up any more of your very busy time studying and reading and getting stuff written down. I know what it's like. I've got to get back to the books. But thank you. Thank you again. Check out Spreaker, Post La Verdad in Spanish, about political issues in Colombia and elsewhere. This has been Colombia Calling, episode 226, the election episode so far. And yes, get in touch with us at Colombia Calling on Twitter, ColombiaCalling@gmail.com email, and on Facebook, Colombia Calling, where you can find anything. So I hope you've learned a lot from this one. My apologies for last week's noisy episode. And of course, it was rendered redundant by Trump deciding not to come to Colombia. But anyway, still an interesting debate, and it's definitely worth a listen, because both my guests Chris Morfus and Victoria Malganan have very interesting things to say. So this is me, Richard McCall, signing off this week. Please make sure you're back next week. I will be talking to Carlos Villalon, who is a war reporter who's been based here and embedded himself with various different groups in the country for more than 15 years, and I will be releasing a book on the failed war on drugs very shortly, so we'll be talking to him about that. Anyway, thank you for listening, and bye-bye.